You are listening to local and regional news produced by KMUN with help from our news partners. I'm Skylar Butenchin. It's Wednesday, December 17th. A massive landslide is blocking road access for tribes near Siletz, forcing them to take side roads. OPB's April Ehrlich reports.
Late last week, a landslide closed Oregon Highway 229, the main route between Lincoln City and Siletz near the coast. Oregon transportation officials say that landslide is still moving, dropping boulders and snapping trees. The Confederated Tribes of Siletz Indians owns multiple offices and housing properties across the region. Angela Sandana is the tribe's natural resources director.
So we have other slides near Siletz on the upper river that's also impacting access to our tribal properties. So yeah, it's a really big deal for us right now.
Tribal members are also worried that debris falling into the Siletz River could harm salmon. Sediment can also degrade water quality for other aquatic life. The region is bracing for another bout of heavy rain, which could trigger even more landslides. I'm April Ehrlich, reporting.
City officials in Astoria say they will continue to monitor recent landslide activity as another storm system approaches the area. Last week, the Northwest was pounded by rain and wind. An estimated 6 inches of rain fell on Monday and Tuesday in Astoria. The heavy rains caused major flooding and slide issues elsewhere in Oregon and Washington. In Astoria, public works crews saw a small amount of movement at 5th and Commercial, and continued movement at 27th Street and the Grand and Irving Avenue areas. Both are known slide areas. That part of Irving Avenue is closed for now because of an uneven roadway surface. Astoria Public Works Director Jeff Harrington anticipates that Irving Avenue will need substantial repair. Still, he says that considering how much damage occurred in other parts of the region, he feels fortunate.
You're listening to KMUN. I'm Katie Frankowitz. Oregon's commercial Dungeness crab fishery officially opened yesterday along most of the coast, to rough ocean conditions and without an agreement on the price per pound. And the coast is only partially open. State fishery managers opted to open Oregon from Cape Falcon near Manzanita to the California border. The North Coast remains closed to the Washington border as fishery managers in that state wait on another round of tests to see if crab have filled out with enough meat to open the fishery there. When Southwest Washington opens, Oregon's North Coast will open too, by December 31st at the earliest. The West Coast Dungeness crab fishery is an incredibly valuable fishery. It's managed under a tri-state agreement between Washington, Oregon, and California, and many crabbers hold licenses for multiple states. Still, to get a better sense of what the partial opening means for Oregon crabbers, I spoke with Crystal Adams, Executive Director of the Oregon Dungeness Crab Commission. One major issue on a lot of people's minds ahead of the season opening was whether or not a U.S. Coast Guard rescue helicopter that had been stationed in Newport for nearly 40 years would return to the area. In late October, the Coast Guard quietly relocated the helicopter. Around the same time, it became clear that U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement was hoping to build a new detention center in Newport. Newport residents, representatives of the fishing industry, and U.S. Senators Jeff Merkley and Ron Wyden pushed back. In November, a temporary judicial order required the helicopter to return. In early December, the Coast Guard committed to permanently returning the rescue helicopter to Newport. I asked Adams what it meant to have the assurance that the helicopter would be back in the area in time for the commercial Dungeness crab season.
Oregon's got quite a coastline. You know, they've got Coast Guard up in Astoria, they've got Coast Guard in North Bend, but in between, that's a lot of stretch. You know, a vessel did go down in Newport a few days ago, day before yesterday. And that, you know, it's really important that a helicopter be there. From what I heard, I've not talked to anybody directly, but the fisherman was in the water about 13 minutes before they were rescued. You know, that wouldn't have happened had that helicopter not been there.
What does it mean for the fishery to open without a starting price point. Usually the industry negotiates, crabbers negotiate with processors and buyers about what the starting price per pound is going to be. And that did not happen this year, or at least it didn't happen in time for the season opening.
Yeah, this is pretty unheard of. I mean, here and there people have set, you know, small groups maybe, but not an entire coast. Many have a buyer that has given them a price, just not negotiated with the state. So some of them have buyers and prices that went out, but many don't. They've been told they'll get a match offer, or maybe they don't want to buy. And, you know, I'm not really sure about why the market is good. The live market really drives the price for crab. I understand that it's not the height of the live market when Chinese New Year is about. It really raises that price up, and it's not time for that yet. But the fresh whole cooks that go out for, you know, what we call the holiday crab, they're out there. There's orders that are being requested, so I hope that something changes when they bring their crab in. I know the processors are always concerned. I was one for a lot of years. They're always concerned about what's out there, right? If there's a lot of crab out there, it's going to drive the price down. And so they're always concerned about that opening price, like setting the standard. But now that they don't have one, you know, they're going to go out, and depending on what they catch, with weather like this, those that catch, it's going to bring their price up because they're not being flooded with product. It's difficult to want to go set your gear not knowing what you're being paid. You do have an opportunity to say, I have crab on. This is what it's worth to me. So I hope that that's the way that it goes this year.
Let's talk about that weather. Currently, there is a gale warning offshore for the entire Oregon coast. But, of course, crabbers have already gone through a pre-soak period. That's when they get to set their gear out. What does this weather mean?
Unfortunately, they're going to probably go fishing, and it's really dangerous when they do that. But their gear's been setting, and there are fishermen wanting to go out and catch crab. So they're going out. They're going to pick up. It means that a lot of people can't go in the fleet, you know, depending on if their boat can handle this type of weather, and it's really unsafe. Really, really good that helicopter came back to Newport.
And finally, what does it mean that the entire Oregon coast is not open to crabbers?
They're hoping that they don't have to have a long delay in between fishing up and down, but some of those guys up north, you know, the smaller vessels, they're not going to travel far south. I mean, you know, they don't have a huge vessel to live on to just go days away from their home. So it's really tough for the different fishermen, depending on where they want to fish.
If you're just tuning in, that was Crystal Adams, Executive Director for the Oregon Dungeness Crab Commission, talking about the season that is currently underway in most of Oregon. This is KMUN.
Democrats in Oregon's congressional delegation are demanding details about any plans to open an immigrant detention center in the state. Dirk Vanderhart reports.
All seven of Oregon's congressional Democrats sent a letter Tuesday to the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. The letter cited recent job postings that suggest ICE has been planning a detention center, either in Newport or in the Portland area. The lawmakers requested a detailed description of any such plans and rejected the need for a new facility. The letter pointed to reports of inhumane conditions at a detention center in Florida's Everglades this year. Speculation has swirled for more than a month that ICE has keyed in on Oregon for a possible facility. That is particularly true in Newport, where a host of inquiries from federal contractors and want ads all point to the possibility of a detention center. But to date, the Trump administration has not confirmed any plans and has not filed necessary paperwork with state officials. I'm Dirk Vanderhart reporting.
Last week, Washington State Attorney General Nick Brown proposed a new bill called the Immigrant Worker Protection Act. The bill would bring stiff fines to Washington farms for not notifying workers if they are being investigated by federal immigration agents. The bill would also bar employers from allowing immigration officials to inspect payroll records without a court order. Brown said in a recent statement that the Trump administration is leading a campaign of fear that has left many people scared to go to work. Washington law prohibits police departments and sheriff's offices from cooperating with ICE agents. The new bill would put new requirements on employers to alert workers to what are called I-9 audits, which refer to the form employees sign attesting they are authorized to work in the U.S. Lying on the form is a federal crime. According to the new bill, if immigration officials start an audit, Washington employers would have 72 hours to notify workers. But not everyone is enthusiastic about the new bill. A nonprofit that provides human resources services to farms, called the Worker and Farmer Labor Association, says if the bill is passed, it would be a, quote, administrative landmine for farms. The nonprofit says violating any part of the bill would cost an employer $2,000 per employee, and if it's a repeat violation, the penalty would be $10,000 per employee. The Washington State Legislature will convene on January 12th for its 60-day session. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Chinook Observer, online at chinookobserver.com. Up next is This Week in Water. After that, stay tuned for the Ship Report with Joanne Rideout.
Some in the West pay high prices for water, while others get it for free. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
The U.S. has been involved in another hijacking. Not the seizure of a Venezuelan oil tanker, but fossil fuels are involved. The Trump administration has helped to tank a U.N. report meant as a roadmap for countries to live sustainably on the planet.
The UN Environment Program released its 7th Global Environmental Outlook in Nairobi, Kenya last week. The report is the product of nearly 300 scientists from 82 countries, and its title, A Future We Choose.
Humans are at a crossroads. The choices are to invest in a stable climate, healthy nature, and a pollution-free planet, or continue business as usual.
If we can choose a path of incentivizing countries to move towards circularity, clean energy, and sustainable agriculture, and away from fossil fuels and plastics, there would be huge benefits.
Benefits like adding trillions of dollars each year in global GDP, avoiding millions of deaths, and lifting hundreds of millions of people out of hunger and poverty in the coming decades.
That was too much to bear for the United States, Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Russia.
According to the New York Times, the U.S. did not attend the conference, but during final negotiations, a State Department official met with negotiators by video call.
The official said the U.S. opposed the final language on climate change, the need to switch to clean energy, biodiversity, and the use of plastics. The worst part of the call, one participant told the Times, was that the American representative didn't even have their camera on.
The BBC reports that in the end, scientists were unwilling to water down or change their findings, so the outlook has now been released without its customary summary for policymakers. The meat of the report, meant to guide governments around energy and environmental policies.
A new study from UCLA says cities in the West pay vastly more for water than districts that supply farmers, and that the price of that water doesn't motivate some of the major users to conserve.
The study shows that the price of water in the West does not accurately account for its growing scarcity at a time when all 7 states in the Colorado River Basin are struggling to come to an agreement on how to allocate shortages caused by drought and climate change.
The researchers focused on the disparities in the price of water in California, Nevada, and Arizona, which make up the lower basin states of the Colorado River.
Based on historic allocations and complex water law, many water districts supplying agriculture pay little or nothing for wholesale water supplies, while some cities pay more than $2,500 per acre foot.
As the authors note, if water's being given away for free or close to it, then there's no incentive to conserve, and the shortage in the Colorado River Basin is accelerated.
They argue that water on its own has no consistent price, and that's a problem because it does not reflect growing scarcity.
The authors call for, among other things, a central database that tracks water prices and water rights, which could help officials and politicians to make better decisions as the climate becomes more arid.
A separate paper authored by the Colorado River Research Group states that reservoirs on the Colorado River used to hold 4 years' worth of water flows, but now they are less than a third full.
The experts suggest that the basin may never rebound from the aridification that's already occurred and will continue, of which climate change is a significant factor. They recommend creating a basin-wide entity where not only experts and political leaders, but also citizens can discuss issues. And finally, governments of 185 countries have agreed to protect the declining number of shark and ray species. Now, more than 70 different kinds of the animals will be included in an international ban on commercial trade, such as manta and devil rays and white-tipped sharks.
The Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora adopted an agreement at the end of last month in Samarkand, Uzbekistan. The convention was first signed in 1973 and was aimed at conserving land animals like pandas, elephants, rhinos, and great apes.
At least one-third of these new protected species are threatened with extinction. Reef sharks have almost vanished from 20% of Earth's coral reefs. Manta rays are hunted and traded for their meat, which can be fed to animals or consumed by humans, but they're mostly used in traditional medicines to increase immunity and detoxify.
Shark fins are considered a Chinese cooking delicacy and shark meat a source of protein. The cosmetic industry has used some sharks' livers as a source of oil for skin care and makeup.
These animals have not been protected before, unlike other species such as tuna, whales, and turtles, some of which have been safeguarded for 40 years.
Implementation of the restrictions and protections, which is a major challenge, will fall to each country, which will impose fines, ship seizures, or even imprisonment.
That's it for this week in water. Support our work at h2oradio.org by December 31st and have your gift doubled.
You're listening to KMUN News. If you have a news tip or story idea, get in touch. Email us at news1@kmun.org. That's news, the numeral 1, at kmun.org. Local and regional news on KMUN is brought to you by our news partners and the KMUN news team. That includes me, host and producer Skylar Butenchin, news intern Sylvia Thorpe, and news director Katie Frankowitz. Our news broadcasts air Monday through Thursday beginning at 7:59 in the morning and 4:59 in the evening.